if you're slowing down or haven't, you know, quite paid attention, I'm coming.
Welcome to the Iditarod, a podcast about what else? The Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race, and we're getting close to the end of that trail, at least for the front runners. I'm your host, Casey Grove. The Iditarod is a production of Alaska Public Media. It's Monday, and wow, have we got an exciting race for first place. Whoever it is, a champion Iditarod sled dog team is likely to finish in Nome early Tuesday morning, and if the pace holds up, it'll be one of the fastest on the northern route. Right now, Brent Sass continues to hold the lead, as he and those wild and free dogs have for the entire second half of the 1,000-mile race. He's looking for his first win, of course, but I'm not going to say he's not looking back over his shoulder because, of course, five-time champ Dallas Seavey is still back there waiting for Sass to make a mistake. We'll have more about that race at the front, more about mistakes, mishaps, mayhem, more about how things are going for the top rookie, the Norwegian Hanna Lyrik, more about moose encounters. There was one in the race, and the moose took the worst of it, as well as the speedy team of Dan Caduce slingshotting past other teams in the last couple of days. And more pizza, please, with Mushers getting some fresh za delivered in Unalakleet. We'll also have more dog, another dog of the day, and a listener question with an answer from out on the trail. Okay, back to the very front of the pack. As I said, Brent Sass is hanging on to first position in the 50th Iditarod, still ahead of Dallas Seavey. Since we last left off, Sass's team hit the coast in Unalakleet, pretty much blowing through that checkpoint except for a few minutes to politely accept the Gold Coast Award and an ounce of gold nuggets. He doesn't have to carry that extra ounce, by the way. It'll be re-presented to him in Nome, as with the other awards he's won along the way. There have been a few. Then it was north to Shaktulik and across the ice of Norton Sound. There's a peninsula, sort of a rocky prominent spot there, and a little cabin to shelter in before heading out on the biggest stretch of sea ice. But Sass didn't stop there either. Farther along, out on the ice and seemingly unprotected from the wind, Sass and his dogs rested for a few hours midway through that 50-mile run. I say seemingly unprotected because in an Iditarod Insider video, you could see that he'd actually had the dogs all bundled up under a big blanket, like all together in a pile, with his sled there also sheltering them from the wind. The insider videographer kept asking him, "Really, this was your plan?" And Brent was like, "Yep, yeah, this is the plan." He seemed totally unfazed. The wind is howling out there, but everybody looked pretty comfortable. When he arrived later in the Koyuk checkpoint a little before 7 p.m. Sunday, he was seen kicking and ski poling to help propel the team forward. Sass said that camping out on the ice, yes, indeed, it had been a tactical decision.
"I wanted to break up this next run to get into White Mountain a little more equally, and the cabin just wasn't, it was too close, and Dallas was going to go there, and I didn't want Dallas to see me, so."
Seavey had stopped at that cabin, and it sounded like both mushers had made those decisions based on their normal run rest schedule and where they wanted to be at the next few checkpoints. So Sass only stopped in Koyuk for a few minutes to pile some supplies on his sled. He says his 12 dogs have been doing really well, even across the glare ice and into headwinds exceeding 30 miles per hour. And he says they've been eating well over the last runs after he worried about their appetite earlier in the race. But Sass and everybody else knows that Seavey is not that far behind him, really just hanging out right there a little less than 20 miles behind. And Sass said, quote, "You can never count Dallas out." Truth to that. As for Seavey, though, he was feeling a little less hopeful about catching Sass when he pulled into Koyuk Sunday, about 2.5 hours behind at that point.
I think we're going to keep on doing everything we can, but I find it unlikely that that's going to be enough, but I'm slowing down."
Maybe not enough, Seavey says, unless Sass makes a mistake. We'll have more about some mistakes coming up, but on the way to Koyuk, the gap between Seavey and Sass had widened by about another 40 minutes. Seavey stopped in Koyuk to give his dog some frozen meat snacks and filled his thermos with coffee inside the checkpoint. Also took a look at the run times so far. And since all teams are required to take an 8-hour rest in White Mountain, that's about 80 miles from the finish, If the first team there has a wide enough lead, they'll leave White Mountain with a rested team, so oftentimes that's who goes on to win the Iditarod. Sure enough, Brent Sass's team has now arrived in White Mountain. It's kind of hard to tell, but it looks like CV has maybe taken a little bit out of that roughly 20-mile lead, but not a whole lot. And Dallas CV is still out on the trail as I'm recording this, heading toward White Mountain, midday now on Monday. But disclaimer, it's not always the case that the first team to reach White Mountain and start that 8-hour rest goes on to win the Iditarod. I said likely, but it doesn't always happen that way. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. In 2014, a big windstorm knocked Jeff King out of the race after he had left White Mountain solidly in the lead. That ultimately led to Dallas Seavey's second of five wins, with Ali Zirkel finishing in second place just a couple minutes behind. The second closest finish of all time. So we still definitely do not know how this is going to end, but it looks like the first teams to reach Nome to mush up off the ice and onto Front Street to pass under the famed finish line, the Burled Arch, that'll be early Tuesday morning if things keep up. Incidentally, folks have been talking about the fast pace of this year's race, with Sass reaching Elim something like 16 hours faster than Thomas Werner did in 2020 on his championship run. The last time Iditarod was on a normal northern route. But in 2014, Jeff King made it to Elim more than 5 hours faster than Sass this year. And even with that storm delaying things a bit for the front runners, CV, again, who won that race, still finished that race with the fastest ever time on the northern route. So it's unlikely we'll see that record broken this year. Anyway, it's not all about the two at the front, as exciting as that is shaping up to be, of course, with Brent Sass going for his first victory in the Iditarod and Dallas CV still vying for his sixth, which would be the most ever. But the Chase Pack, if we can call them that, are making that run from Shaktuluk to Koyuk over the sea ice. And look who it is. As I'm recording this, Chad Stoddard is in third place in just his second Iditarod, mushing that Dallas CV B team heading into Koyuk. Super impressive, although that could still change today depending on run rest schedules and a whole host of other things. Potential pitfalls, again, we're going to get into that in a minute. After Stoddard, there's a pair of Aarons, Alberta musher Aaron Peck and the gnome-grown Aaron Burmeister in what he says will be his last Iditarod. On Sunday in Unalakleet, Burmeister talked about that, first about his team and having a great run so far, but then he got a little emotional. Here he is, courtesy of Iditarod.com and Iditarod Insider.
If I'm not planning on racing anybody, I'm planning on going checkpoint to checkpoint right now to Nome. But they're prepared to go from here to Koyuk and from Koyuk to White Mountain on a trail like this. It would be really easy. And I can easily do it with these guys. But why? I want to enjoy it. I want to stay here a few hours, Shaktuluk, Koyuk, Elim, and Nome. And if somebody wants to make a push on me, go for it. But it's hard to push somebody that's running a healthy, fast dog team. And they're going to make a push and take some speed out of them, and we'll just let it go as it is. But I'm going to try to enjoy it. If the wheels start coming apart on the teams ahead of me, they took some big gambles to put themselves in the position they're in. I wasn't willing to make those gambles myself. And if it pays off for them, kudos to them, because those were big moves. Both of them made different ones. And more power to him. I mean, that's to make it work and pull it off is awesome. I'm just kind of on a joy ride.
Pretty good joy ride where you're sitting.
Well, it's hard. It's hard looking around and seeing family and friends and thinking. I always think about next year. Every time I'm around the race, I'm thinking about what I'm going to improve for next year. It's hard not to think about next year. That's a lot.
But this is your country to enjoy.
But no,
now.
I'm home. I'm enjoying it. I love it. This is life. That's the hard part of this race. This year's race for me. But it's been a pleasure driving this dog team. It really has.
Burmeister there, overcome with emotion, gets up and walks away. It must be tough having put so much time in, spending so much time and effort with those dogs over the years. I mean, this is his 21st Iditarod, and it sounds and looks like he's having an amazing run this year, looking at another top 10 finish, if not higher. He's made the top 10 seven times, with his highest finish second place last year. And as with many sports, that kind of success means avoiding mistakes, whether it's through luck or good planning. Yeah, a lot can go wrong over 1,000 miles and more than a week on the trail. And certainly, something will at some point. Whether it's wet river crossings or wrong turns, we got six Iditarod mushers to share their most frustrating mishaps over this year's course. All six are included in a story at alaskapublic.org. But for just a little taste of that mayhem, we have three of those here today on the Iditapod. First, here's that other Aaron Peck, talking about his biggest mistake this year.
Leaving Roan checkpoint, if you're blowing through Roan like a lot of people do, it's kind of a rushed, you know, express lane there because there's other teams coming and there's limited help around or whatever. So you want to get your food, your straw, and most importantly, your heat, the fuel we use to light the cooker to melt the water to feed the dogs. And I had gone, 300 yards down the trail, almost to a point of no return, because once you go out onto the ice, good luck, you know. And I'm doing the circle check in my head, you know, and I'm just like, oh, heat. So I panicked. I tied the team off, flipped the sled on its side, secured them so they weren't going to go anywhere, and doubled back on foot and ran back to the checkpoint. And I was huffing and puffing because it was warm. I was just sweaty. It was just, and I was praying another team wasn't going to be coming because my team was blocking the trail. And I just grabbed five bottles of heat and peeled back and got the dogs and got going. But that was quite a delay. You know, by all the time I wasted in Roan, I should have just stayed there and camped.
Dang, definitely a delay, but that probably kept him in the race, turning around to go back and get the heat. Okay, now here's Two Rivers musher Matt Hall, a Yukon Quest champ, who almost went without a piece of gear too, but not because he'd forgotten it.
Two of my Lupin batteries, which are $130 a piece, I put in this pocket, which just has a tiny little piece of Velcro on it, and got down the trail a little ways, heading into Cripple, and went for my backup battery and my backup battery, and neither of them were in my pocket. I was like, oh man, which is fine. I have other Lupin batteries. Like, I have plenty of light. It was more the convenience and expense of a loss of putting them in a pocket I knew I shouldn't have.
Do you know how they fell out of there?
I don't. Like, I must have taken my coat off. Like, I use my coat, like my parka up there right now, covering up certain dogs that need it. Whether they have like shoulders and they've got a bunch of oils on them, and I want it to stay like nice and warm, things like that. So going to pick the coat up, I have a feeling that's what happened in this case, because when I got into this checkpoint here, into Ruby, excuse me, the last checkpoint, the Barrington twins showed up and they were like, hey Matt, and they handed me one of my two missing batteries, and they're like, hey, the volunteers found this at Ophir when they were raking straw, and they said to bring it to you. So that was super, super awesome of them. I lost a mitten last year on the trail too, which they also picked up and brought into McGrath for me.
Matt Hall there, talking about dropping stuff, probably familiar to some of us. And all I know is if I still had all the gloves I've lost over the years, they'd probably fill up an entire dog sled bag, if not a swimming pool. And for sure, we've all gotten turned around from time to time looking for the right trail. It seems like it wouldn't be so hard to follow one trail, but what if there's more than one option? Here is Deke Nachtgeboren.
I was coming up off the Yukon River, and I was looking for the turnoff because I'd been here once before, and I didn't see it. So my lead dog took me across the street, and we went all the way around the fine town of Galena and checked out the library and the hospital. And there was a bunch of kids that came out and were waving at us and stuff. And
nobody turned you around?
Someone on a snow machine, Bryce, actually. I know Bryce. He found me and said, you know, go this way. And so I made it my way back, but I think I did like an extra 3 miles.
So. And can you explain how it happened to start with? Like, you were going down the river, there's trail markers there. How'd you miss the trail markers?
Yeah, I don't know. I came up off the river, and I'm not sure if I came up off the river at the wrong spot or I came up off the river on the right spot and then missed my next turn. But all of a sudden, we crossed the street, and there were no trail markers and no tracks. And you don't just 180 at 11 dog sled team. You can't do it. So I was, especially on a plowed out road where you can't get your snow hook in to stop them. So I was just kind of along for the ride until we worked our way around town and found the community center here.
Well, we're glad that Deke and Co. got to the checkpoint. He and the others we mentioned are now farther down the trail, and they're online, along with several more, talking about their mistakes, mishaps, at alaskapublic.org. But Deke Nachtigaborn, who, like he said, has raced the Iditarod before, is actually behind someone else at the moment who has not raced Iditarod before. That's probably not uncommon, depending on giving up time recovering from mistakes or dealing with whatever else. And that someone else, we've mentioned her before, is Hanna Lyrick. Lyrick continues to lead all of the rookies in this year's race, so obviously a strong contender for Rookie of the Year. As Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan reports, while this may be the 22-year-old's first Iditarod, she already has an impressive mushing resume.
Hanna Lyrick is wearing a hand-knit sweater and wool hat with dog designs knitted into it as she booties her dogs at the Galena checkpoint on Saturday afternoon. She's prepping for her run to Nilato, and her dogs are cranky as they awake from a slumber.
Hey!
Her face is red from days on the trail, racing into sometimes heavy snow and strong headwinds. Other times she's raced in bright sunshine, especially over the past few days. She's a little bit tired.
Where are we?
So I'm going to remind you.
Are we in Galena?
Well, she's a newbie to the Iditarod. Lyrick already has proven her mettle in long-distance dog mushing by winning the 2019 600-kilometer Finnmarksløpet, one of the biggest races in Europe. She was just 19 years old. Now, Lyrick is 22 and more than halfway through her first Iditarod. She's the closest rookie to the front, setting her up to win this year's Rookie of the Year award. She's hours ahead of her closest competition, but she's not thinking about it.
Not really, because it's such a long way to go, and I want to finish.
Instead, she's focused on the scenery around her, as well as the challenges of each run. The sub-zero temperatures she encountered on the Yukon River the day before were something she hasn't experienced in Norway, she says. She tried to keep her blood flowing.
I didn't have to kick because we were moving pretty fast. So I had some other moving around things that I did to keep warm.
She says a run through the snowless area into Nikolai, known as the Farewell Burn, was also a challenge. But overall, she says she's unfazed by the trail. She consulted with a few fellow Norwegians, Jor Leifsef Olsom and Thomas Werner, both Iditarod champions. She remembers asking them how bad the Dalsdale Gorge would be, but found it to be relatively straightforward.
That was not bad at all. Like, not at all.
Mushing runs in Lyrick's family. Her dad, Don Lyrick, and her mom, Trina, are both Iditarod finishers who met through mushing. He's American and she is Norwegian. Both will meet her in Nome. So far, though, she hasn't texted them, even though she does have an in-reach satellite phone.
Actually, I haven't talked to them since I left, so. I saw my dad on the trail at a checkpoint, but I haven't talked to them.
Lyrick lived in Alaska until she was 5 years old, and then she moved to Alta, Norway with her family, where she still lives today. She helps with the sled dog guiding business there. She says she tried to go to college in Alta, but withdrew after less than a year because she didn't want to be pulled away from her dogs.
Too much to do when you want to do well in mushing, and I'm pretty dedicated and spend all my time with the dogs.
That decision helped her solidify a bond with the dogs, despite a nearly two-year pandemic-related hiatus on dog racing in Norway. She calls her dogs her Corona team due to their inexperience around racing. So far, though, they're doing just fine, and she's got her sights set on the future.
But yeah, hopefully I can be doing long races and be even more competitive as I get older and more experienced.
As for winning the Iditarod someday, she says maybe. But she says she'd be grateful just to get a chance to come do it again. Reporting in Galena, I'm Lex Trinan.
Very cool. Thanks to Lex Trinan for that story. And if you haven't had a chance yet and you want to know more about Lyrick's journey to this year's Iditarod, maybe check out that extended interview with her posted as a bonus episode in your podcast feeds. That one was also with Lex from before the race. Lyrick is one of 13 rookies to start the race, and maybe surprisingly, only one rookie has scratched so far. But the latest scratch was not a rookie. It was actually Fairbanks musher Joshua McNeil, racing in his second Iditarod after completing the pandemic-altered course last year, who decided to bow out in Galena Sunday night. We are now down to 44 mushers, with Lisbeth Norris bringing up the rear in that Red Lantern position. Somewhere there, farther up in the middle of the pack, we've heard about a run-in with a moose that occurred late Saturday. Apparently, just outside of Galena, there was a moose getting aggressive with the teams of a pair of Martins now, Iditarod champ Martin Boozer and rookie Martin Massicotte. We are told that both of them made it past the moose, but then Kuskokwim 300 champ and Iditarod veteran Matthew Fahler had a harder time. He apparently had to shoot the moose, which killed it, and due to provisions in the race rules that he needed to help salvage the meat, I'm sure that that delayed him some. We're still looking for an update on that, and it's unfortunate for the moose, of course, but it sounds like the dogs and the humans made it through okay. And to make an awkward segue, the preservation of dogs, at least the ability to keep them in the team and running down the stretch, can really help a musher pick up positions in the last third or quarter of the Iditarod. We've seen that before where mushers were banking rest. They were keeping that team strong for later in the race and then just passing all kinds of people in the final stretches. If you start with 14 and you can keep all 14 happy and healthy pulling hard, it stands to reason that you'll be mushing faster than the other teams who've had to drop dogs along the way. On Sunday, when our Lex Trinan caught up with veteran musher Dan Caduce in Unalakleet, he was the only musher still in the race with all 14 dogs. Caduce was and is solidly in the top 10, and he was calm and relaxed in the dog yard there in Unalakleet, chomping down on a piece of pizza between dog chores. We're going to have more about that pizza coming up too, by the way. But just from looking at him, you'd hardly know that Caduce had had the fastest run times of the competition coming down the Yukon River. So how has he done it?
That is a, I don't know. It's just lucky. You know, you do things enough and every now and then you get lucky. And I could still, you know, have a six dog team in Nome.
Like other mushers, Caduce says he's put a lot of effort into dog care. He says he particularly focuses on giving the dogs lots of food, as well as adapting to different temperatures.
If it's warm out, I try not to feed very much while they're running, only while they're resting. If it's cold, they can get it shoveled at them, you know, every 2 hours.
The Chattanooga-based musher ran from Unalakleet to Shaktulik in 5 hours and 7 minutes, besting the run times of every team in front of him by over a half hour. And those fast, steady runs and strong team have helped Caduce move through the field. He left McGrath about a third of the way through the race in 20th place. Then by the halfway mark, he was in 11th. In Unalakleet, he was sitting in 7th, and he'd maintained that spot up the coast the last time I checked. Well, Caduce has been a competitive musher for a while and has won a handful of Yukon Quest 300-mile races. He's not focusing on trying to beat other sled dog teams. Not necessarily, anyway.
For me, the way to go is just to mush the team in front of me and pay no attention. You know, if you're faster than me or willing to cut enough rest, have at it. If you're slowing down or haven't, you know, quite paid attention, I'm coming.
But Caduce says just because he has 14 dogs now doesn't mean he'll be able to keep them all the way to the finish line in Nome. Just based on personal experience, I wonder if throwing those dogs some of that pizza crust might help. Whether it makes them faster or not, I'm sure that they would enjoy it. And the reason we're talking about pizza now is because of a popular pizza joint in Unalakleet. It's called Peace on Earth, and what's cool and different about them is that, kind of as a tradition in the race, folks following along can call in delivery orders for the mushers. They end up eating a lot of easy-to-cook meals out on the trail and really whatever they can get in the checkpoints. But then they hit Unalakleet, and there's this piping hot pizza, in some cases delivered right to them in the dog yard. Alaska Public Media's Jeff Chen reports.
Last year, when musher Pete Kaiser scratched from the 2021 Iditarod race, a pilot named Jonathan Hansen flew him back home to Bethel.
You're the guy that flew me last year.
Yeah, I was the one who flew you home from McGrath last year.
The two met again Sunday afternoon here in Hansen's hometown as Kaiser arrived in the coastal Inupiat community.
I don't want to interrupt you too much, but we got some pizza here for you.
This time, instead of giving Kaiser a ride home to Bethel, Hansen delivered him a couple pizzas as he checked in at the Unalakleet checkpoint.
We get orders from all over the world, and for most of the mushers that have come in, we've delivered pizzas to them down here on the ice.
Hansen says his parents' restaurant, Peace on Earth, has been delivering pizzas to the checkpoint for 25 years. Musher Chad Stoddard was delighted to sit down for a slice. His mom, a few thousand miles away in Washington, ordered him a sausage and bacon pizza. He read her message out loud as he took his first bite.
It says, Chad Stoddard, we are proud of you. We love you. You're doing great. Nome wasn't built in a day.
Stoddard was last year's Iditarod Rookie of the Year, but the trail didn't pass through Unalakleet due to COVID mitigation.
It's been really neat to see all the villages and experience this part of the trail that I did not get to see last year. That's been really fun.
There's still time to order a pizza for the rest of the mushers coming through Unalakleet. Hansen says he got a pizza order in from Abu Dhabi the other day, a family wanting to give thanks to the crew running the Iditarod live stream online.
Oh, man. I can't count how many trips I've made down here.
In Unalakleet, the pizza hub of the Iditarod, I'm Jeff Chen.
It sure sounds like they're keeping that delivery guy busy. And we're going to stay busy here on the Iditapod, so let's go straight to today's listener question.
Hey, Iditapod. This is Elle from Chicago. I am a longtime pod listener, and I have been getting lots of my friends into the Iditapod because I'm obsessed. And I have interestingly heard from multiple people at this point that they're really confused by your use of the word snow machines. Because here in the lower 48, we call them snowmobiles. And a lot of people don't seem to realize that that's what you're talking about. So I thought I would ask, first of all, why do you think it is that Alaskans use a different term? And also, I'm just curious to hear you explain a little bit, because so many people have asked me about what role snow machines play in the kind of administration of the Iditarod and in mushing in general, and how snow machines interact with dog teams, etc. So if you can shed any light on this matter and on this linguistic disconnect between Alaska and the lower 48, I would be very curious.
I'm Mark Oshesky, and I live in Palmer, Alaska. This is my 12th year. I help move people and material around before, during, and after the race. So when all the musher bags and stuff that have to go out to the checkpoint, I'm the guy that loads it on a plane or unloads it when it comes back and makes sure it gets back to town.
All right, so we have a listener question coming in about why Alaskans say snow machines versus snowmobiles.
Well, I'm from Vermont, and in Vermont we have sleds. So, and I grew up and it was snowmobiles. Now that I live in Alaska, it's snow machines. Why? I do not know.
What are the roles of snow machines in the Iditarod?
Biggest one is probably trail breakers. They come through, they all ride snow machines. So basically they break trail for the dogs. At the end of the race, we have trail sweeps, which also ride snow machines. And basically they pick up any trash that's left behind by Iditarod. At checkpoints, the snow machines are used to move material from one part of the checkpoint to another. Or so if a plane comes in, we'll bring a snow machine over there, unload the plane, bring all the gear to wherever it's got to go, and vice versa. When people are leaving, we'll load up the snow machine, bring material over to the planes so that they can take off and have everything that they need.
How do you get the snow machines out to the trail in the first place?
Trail breakers basically start in Anchorage, so they can get to Anchorage quite from to Willow quite easily. As far as we just, here in McGrath, we just had a snow machine that is now going to spend the rest of its life in Cripple. So when the trail breakers came, basically they put that snow machine on a trailer behind the snow machine and dragged it out to Cripple. And now it'll be used in Cripple to help them move materials around. As far as the rest of them, I mean, people in town once in a while will donate a snow machine and it'll stay in here. When people in out in the village get one, it usually comes in on a cargo plane, like Knack or Linden.
Thanks, Elle, for the question. Thanks, Mark, for the answer. It really is kind of a mystery as to why we say snow machine up here. Sometimes people think you're talking about snowmakers when you say snow machine, referring to those things that spray snow on ski trails. As far as anybody can remember, though, we've just said snow machine in Alaska to refer to the vehicle, which out in bush Alaska off the road system, they're pretty much the preferred method of transportation in the wintertime. And with snow machines, in case you didn't know, you just press down on the gas and the thing goes forward. You press down more and it goes faster. But how does that work with a sled dog team? There isn't exactly a throttle. So you need a good leader, somebody peppy who always wants to run. And that brings us to our dog of the day. It's Chevelle from Paige Drobny's team. Drobny talked to Alaska Public Media's Tegan Hanlon about Chevelle at the ceremonial start in Anchorage, what, over a week ago now? I'm losing track of time. There's also a little cameo in here from a dog named Coop. Anyway, here's Paige Drobny.
Yeah, well, so I have another 8-year-old dog named Chevelle, and she has finished multiple thousand mile races too, but she barks while we're running. And so if the team slows down too much, then she starts barking to get them to go faster. If we're going too slow on a hill, or if she sees a team up ahead, she's like loves to race. And she's like, hey, I see you, and like starts barking like, hey, let's catch them, catch them, catch them. So she adds a lot of energy to the team. Sometimes in bad situations, she also likes to bark if we're on, hey Coop, it's okay, buddy. If we like hit some ice or something and she hears the brake claws, then she'll bark and that makes everyone go faster. So it can be a little dangerous also sometimes.
So she's like a cheerleader, but maybe, what's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, I guess good or bad cheerleader a little bit.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, you know, every time she barks, it makes me laugh. And the fact that she's done this, you know, she's probably run 30,000 or plus miles in her life and she still gets excited about all the same little things. And it's really cool to, you know, just the energy that she brings to the team is really awesome.
What position is she in the team usually?
I think she's gonna run out of here lead today.
Exciting.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Cool.
The ever-present dog sounds of dog mushing and our dogs of the day. I just love it. Like I said, Coop there making a cameo. Our next dog of the day, if all goes well, will most likely be the Golden Harness winner, so that's exciting. That'll be tomorrow, Tuesday, on the Ididapod. When we have a first place finisher, we'll post a short, quick update on that finish, looking like Brent Sass at the moment, but who knows? And you'll find that in your podcast feeds at alaskapublic.org soonest. Then, of course, we'll have another full episode to follow. And as always, you can find all of our stories, dog profiles, a whole bunch of photos, and more at alaskapublic.org. That theme music you're hearing, it's by the band Sassafras. Our Ididapod team, it's Tegan Hanlon, Lex Trinan, and Jeff Chen. Thanks to them for all the hard work. Thanks to you, too, for listening. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails.
Oh, my God, cute.